So on the last episode, we chatted about the decision to manage some athletes non-operatively based on a variety of reasons, being in season, age, some of the other risk factors that Catherine had mentioned. However, the article by Dr. Hetrich highlighted that race may also contribute to this decision, albeit likely subconsciously. This study that she published found that non-white patients had more dislocations compared to white patients, and that this coincided with more frequent glenoid bone loss, articular cartilage damage, and Hill-Sachs lesions. The authors concluded this is likely multifactorial, relating to a mix of cultural attitudes concerning medical care, bias of providers, and other socioeconomic factors. So obviously this is concerning. This was a concerning finding to me reading this. And so I'm just wondering, Dr. Price, when we were residents there, we had a part of our core curriculum was geared towards subconscious bias, addressing it and correcting it. Wondering if still with the residents today, if that's still a program, if that's evolved at all, how residents and fellows are educated in terms of addressing this and trying to minimize this conclusion of this paper.
I mean, this was a great paper. These are the papers that really are going to change practice patterns, right? You know, I know we get all excited about, hey, I did a rotator cuff this way, and aren't I cool? And hey, I fixed these, and then I didn't fix these, and they're all the same. I get it. But in terms of really moving the needle on how we impact larger groups, this says, like, keep your antennae up, right? That when you have that person in your clinic, that maybe they're more inclined to minimize their symptoms, or maybe their symptoms don't nicely match our categories, right? You know, in the previous episode, we were talking about, well, they present, you know, someone with this presents more with pain than with instability, et cetera. But we all do that as doctors, right? We categorize. And if it doesn't fit nicely into our box of 300 of these that we've seen, we try and cram it into some other box. And you know, this gets dangerous, right? When we're talking about like women with heart disease, for example, kind of the predecessor to these sorts of things. But this is, you know, certainly of that same vein that says, you know, when you have that 18-year-old African-American high school player that just says, I don't know, my shoulder doesn't feel right, you got to take that seriously, right? Like, go ahead and investigate it the same way you would if it were that 18-year-old white female that says, my shoulder feels like it slips this direction or that direction. You know, maybe they just have a different nomenclature for explaining that or whatever. But unless you have your antennae up, you're going to miss those things. And it all goes back to, yes, take a good history, but you've also got to be smart about how you elicit that history. So that when somebody tells you my shoulder doesn't feel right, it's not, your responsibility doesn't end there. It's ask more questions. Hey, what do you do that makes it not feel right? Right? Like, you may have to spend a little more time on it to get somebody to bring out what they're talking about. And I think that paper that Catherine did just really, really teaches us, like, if you don't do that, you're doing a big disservice for your people, for your patients, for your population. So, you know, Ashley, apropos of what you were asking, yes, the residency still focuses on that. And I think, you know, one of the things that we continually need to be reminded of is that we don't get it, right? Like, we're still not there, and we can focus on it, and we can pat ourselves on the back for, hey, we've got this program, et cetera, et cetera. But here you see a paper from 2020 that is, you know, it's not digging back data from the 40s. It's digging back data from the last couple of years. And it says, like, you're clearly, you don't got it. And it's not like these are bad people, or they're trying to do the wrong thing, or they're rushing people out of their clinic. You know, with, you know, she obviously, I thought she did a good job making reference to the insurance issue, right? Saying, you know, back to that ACL study, if you, you know, called up with Medicare, you had a 14% chance of getting an appointment versus an 80-something percent chance within 2 weeks. You know, okay, let's admit there's probably a lot of that still happens. But I think that it definitely makes you question, you know, how you handle those things. And if it's somebody that doesn't, you know, look like you, sound like you, talk like you, or fit into the boxes of the 95% of the patients that you see, that doesn't absolve you of your responsibility to ask those questions, to figure those things out. And, you know, and I think this paper says that you need to be smarter about the questions you ask, or you need to ask more of them to get at this, because clearly it can't be just because folks like these aren't coming into the clinic. It also has to be some element of when they're in the clinic, we're not diagnosing it right away. Or we're not teaching our trainers in the high schools how to be on the lookout for these sorts of things, you know? And so I thought this was a really important paper and a good thing to remind ourselves of. I know when I went through residency, there was exactly zero discussion of these sorts of things. The fact that there's some is good. And I think it's one of those things where, I get it. Like, we need to learn how to fix ankle fractures, and you guys got to learn how to scope a shoulder, et cetera. We got 5 years, but there's also, you know, paying attention to these sorts of things, as part of your, you know, not just lectures on a, you know, Wednesday morning, but really paying attention to them in clinic, you know, when you see those folks is really, really important. And so I think that we've got to be on the lookout for it. And by no means are we ready to start patting ourselves on the back with it yet.
Yeah. I think, you know, a couple points, like just as far as like you brought up gender too, you know, it's not that long ago that like all the data started to come out of like, oh, we should actually look at gender when we're looking at all these different procedures or diagnoses. And, you know, that's only been a recent hot topic. So we're, you know, even behind further when it's comes to race or culture. And I think, similarly, we've been speaking about this, at least Ashley and I, a lot lately about the psychological impact, you know, of diagnoses. So there's just so many other points outside of like technique and should we be doing Laterge versus Bankart, you know, and I think we spend so much of our time investigating those things, but, you know, all these other gaps that exist that I think will only get better as, you know, the field itself gets more diverse and there's more, you know, energy placed, because obviously the gender stuff didn't even start to come until there were some women in the field. And, you know, we're pretty abysmal with, you know, just having a diverse orthopedic workforce. So I think as that sort of grows, you know, all those things will continue to grow. But yeah, like you said, way behind, nowhere close.
Well, did you all see at the recent ANA AOSSM meeting, Joe Hannafin gave a great, great talk. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was orthopedics is still the least diverse of all specialties. Yeah. You know, it's me, right? It's bald white men. Maybe not all bald, but I mean, it's true. And it's unless we get, you know, you, Ashley, you, Catherine, like in the spots and obviously Dr. Hannafin in the spots where they can really demonstrate like, here's a pathway, here's how you do it. It's going to continue to be difficult for us because, you know, I really don't think people are ill-intentioned in this. I think it's just comes from ignorance. I mean, if you don't know, you know, I've never worn a bra, right? Like let's not to be crass, but right there, that's a thing that's not going to occur, you know, in certain circles, right? Stuff like that. I think it's just, unless you have some kind of exposure, experience, whatever, you're going to miss things. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it matters. I mean, they've pointed out time and time again that having a diverse group of people making decisions, coming up with, you know, treatment algorithms and how you approach things leads to less things being missed, right? So if you have more people that are U.S. minorities, that are non-white individuals, that are female individuals in an area that tends to be primarily, as you said, white males, perhaps some of these discrepancies won't happen. Perhaps they're a little bit more culturally in tune or can connect with them on a different basis. And perhaps those things won't be missed, you know, as readily. So I do think it's important, not only from having a good workforce, like Catherine pointed out, but also for our patients as well, too.
And it's, you know, keep in mind, we're appropriately talking about the medical aspects of it. But that sort of analysis actually has been shown in business, in law, and you know it's not a question anymore. It is in my mind resolved that it makes you better when you have access to more people with more experiences. And the question is, what's the best way to go about getting there? Right? What's the best way to do that moves the needle? But it's the debate of whether or not that matters, I think is open. Like it does. We know it. Let's just figure out how to make it work now.
For sure. I always think about, so when my husband, when he started business school, you know, the first thing that they do is, so he was at Dartmouth and
They get assigned a study group, and the school assigns it, and it's very purposely like, you're from this sort of field, you're from that sort of background. Like, it, you know, they make each little study group as diverse as possible. And then you are stuck with those people for the entire year, you know, and you're doing everything together, every project together. And, you know, the amount of growth that they all experience is, you know, exponential, just because they are just like, oh, wow, you have this totally different background than me. Whereas, you know, if like you walk into a new school and you're allowed to pick your own, you're just going to be like, that guy looks like me, I'm going over there, you know? So it does, I'm sure it's hard at moments, but like really
productive. No, there's certain, and sometimes it's just, you've got to be thrown into those environments. I mean, for me, you know, part of that was being in the Navy, that, you know, you go have lunch with, you know, some of the other folks in your unit that maybe you wouldn't naturally gravitate towards, and you learn a different side of life. Like you understand why people vote the way they do, why people, you know, buy things that they buy and stuff like that. And unless you spend some time doing that, you're just gonna miss it. You're gonna live in the bubble that says you're always right and everyone's always wrong, which is a Harvard specialty, but we're trying to get that down a little bit.
Good to have you there.
Yes. Good to have you keeping us updated on that progress.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's only been 300 years, but we're grinding away.
All right. So we'll shift our discussion to surgery. Okay. So if we're talking about those traumatic anterior instability cases, how do you, you know, definitely, in part of my training, there were some folks who would go very quickly to, say, a bony procedure like Lattergy. And then, and obviously that would depend, like we were talking about earlier, a lot on the factors of that individual. But can you walk us through when you are doing soft tissue versus bone, Lattergy, et cetera?
So this has become more and more interesting, you know, as I've gone further and further. And I've made this argument on a few occasions, and I feel like I get decent confirmation of this, and a lot of it depends on what other folks, other players who are with them, have seen before. And what I mean by that is, I've probably done one or two bank arts on hockey players at the Division I or professional level, and I don't even know how many Lattergy's, a boatload, let's call it. And conversely, in the NFL, I can tell you this, I've never done a Lattergy on an NFL player. I'm aware of, you know, one or two over the years, you know, that have come to us probably from elsewhere. And right, we wrote this up for the combine as well. The number of Lattergy's over like a 6-year period was vanishingly small. And it's not because Lattergy doesn't work or people don't know how to do it. It's football players all know other football players who've had bank cards, and they say, he's doing well, why am I going to do something different from that? And likewise, we know hockey players who they say, no, you did a Lattergy on my roommate. You know, he's doing well, that's what I want. And then, you know, it's interesting to be having this conversation today. You know, if we were having this maybe 6 months ago, a year ago, the sort of standard I would always say to people is right, with Lattergy, we let you out there a little bit quicker, right? Sometimes 4 months versus 6 months for a soft tissue procedure, which becomes a really big selling point for some of these guys. You know, and then there was the paper in AJSM, you know, just, I want to say 4 months ago, basically saying like, they don't get their strength back until 6 months. And a lot of them are still feeling not that great. So it was kind of a perfect that says, oh, maybe we're pushing those guys out. You know, they're healed, but are they ready to go? Probably two different questions as far as that goes. And so our bank arts do well at 6 months because they're healed and ready to go. And our Lattergy's do well because they're healed. They're not ready to go, but you're doing them on a population that, you know, does fine kind of no matter what you do, especially for me, because like I said, it's mostly hockey players. So I would not, you know, I guess I don't want you to take that answer to mean that, well, the reason you do a Lattergy is because they play hockey, the reason you do bank art is because they play football. That's not exactly true. You know, certainly there's the stuff, you know, let's stipulate to, right? If they've got a lot of bone loss, et cetera, you're not going to make a bank art work under the wrong conditions. But, you know, I'll tell you, for a lot of these players who have that kind of experience and they've been around and they're savvy, they're more than happy to do what the guy before them did. And I think you tend to default along those lines. I know for me, I present all of the options and you guys I've said this to each of you is, you know, you present your options, but then have an opinion, you know, tell them what mm-hmm. you would do. I'm not a big fan of like, well, here are the six things you can do. What do you want to do? Right. I think, you would hear me in clinic say, when my plumber came in, I didn't want him to tell me about all the pipe fittings. I wanted him to tell me that the toilet wasn't running anymore. And you know, we're not a whole lot better. Let's be honest. We may not be any better. Let's be honest. But, you know, it's one of those things where, okay, let's talk about everything. So it's an informed decision, but then, you know, tell them what you do. And I think what we have the benefit of with football a lot of times is, apropos of our earlier conversation, these guys are happy to play with that for some period of time. And then you get them at the end of season and you've got 6 months to rehab them. And so they say, and if you believe based on your imaging, their exam, et cetera, that you can get a good soft tissue repair, they've got the 6 months to recover. And that's a sort of a golden opportunity. You know, you're going to do the right surgery for the right patient at the right time with the right rehab and not rush it. And they'll do pretty well. So I would say, you know, usually with those, that's probably a large part of why you're doing soft tissue in them. And then likewise with the hockey players, I think, you know, especially for the high school and things like that, it really is, at least in the Northeast where I am, much more of a year-round sport that they want as little time out as possible so that they get much more interested. Their eyes light up when they hear, you know, the 4 months or whatever. So.
I was going to say, have you sort of clinically seen that strength difference between 4 and 6 months?
I haven't, but I'm going to be honest with you. It's almost certainly because I haven't been looking, right? You know, you in clinic, we do such a, you know, no one's bringing a dynamometer. No one's doing a real job here. So right. It's kind of like, you know, unless they had something really gross, like, you know, they were a 4 out mm-hmm. of 5, like with a drop arm, like, I'll admit, like I'm unlikely to pick it up because, you know, again, it goes back to that. If they're doing well, you don't try to convince them they're not. But I would argue that attitude does that patient a disservice. And you know, I know for me, in the last 6 months, I've stepped up my game. And I used to basically cut folks loose at 4 months after a Lattergé, as long as they had X-ray evidence of healing, normal motion, gross normal strength. And instead, I don't cut them loose till I let them go out, but I do a 4 month, but I also do a 6 month visit as well, where we don't take x-rays, but I really do try to measure their strength. And I'm much more neurotic at 4 months about getting, you know, showing them their strength. And so I do push, you know, a lot harder for supraspinatus testing to let them see like, hey, you are still just a little bit weak here. You got to keep working on that. If you do, you'll be much, much happier with this result. So it did make me, you know, reassess, but I've spent 10, 12 years doing it the wrong way.
Well, we've talked a lot about Lattergé as the bone block procedure, but you know, one of the papers did talk about using iliac crest autograft, and then there's also been, you know, distal tibia allograft. Do you always do Lattergé? Do you ever use either a free autograft or an allograft? And if so, like, what makes you move in that direction?
So I'm glad you sent me that paper too, Ashley, because you know, the real takeaway from that paper on top of the technique and everything else was there was no graft resorption, right? Like I don't know that there are many procedures out there, and it was 28 patients, right? We're not talking like it was a case series of 5 or something like that. Like it is a decent, you know, probably underpowered, but still you'd expect in 28, like you'd see something, and they had basically zero. And so in my mind, it brings up again, you know, probably some degree of reassessing some of these things. What I would say, I still, and I think a lot of folks believe this still, the advantage to Lattergé is not in the bone block. It's in the other stuff, right? It's the fact that you're splitting the subscap. It's the fact that you've got the conjoint tendon on there. It's the fact that you've got this sort of dynamic position where you tighten it. And so the bone block, you know, I think a lot of us think that that's probably third, right? And this paper to some degree proves that you can be off by 5 millimeters medial lateral and you still get an equivalent result. And they do outstanding. And you know, maybe that part that's 5 millimeters off or whatever gets a little more graft resorption because of Wolf's Law, et cetera. But they don't come back in complaining of instability. And I know early in my career, I would see that patient. They would be totally fine. We'd get an X-ray. It would show some graft resorption. I would be really, really aggressive about it, and you know, probably had a half dozen that I took back and scoped and did biopsies. And of that half dozen, probably two or three came back with P. acnes, which, you know, now in retrospect, I'm sure was a contaminant. But what do? We took out the screws, we debrided it, you know, da da da, and the patient was just as fine after the surgery as they were before the surgery. And you know, I eventually had fortunately enough patients who were smarter than me that said, "I'm not letting you touch me. Like, I feel fine," and they go out and do great. So I still think Lattergy has some advantages that the quote unquote bone block procedures don't have. That being said, there are circumstances where the bone block procedures are absolutely crucial. Okay, right. Failed Lattergy. Fine. Let's take that one off the table. But, you know, you get into some of these, you know, where they start becoming more of like a glenoid fracture than a bony Bankart. Like, I always think, you know, when someone's talking about 25% loss of the glenoid,
right.
I guess I get it. It's a bony Bankart. But to me, that's like a displaced glenoid fracture, because you can get screws into that fragment. So if you're putting screws into it, it's a fracture. And, you know, we've all been there, right, where you're trying to put screws in that fragment and suddenly you've got Swiss cheese, or that fragment really looked beautiful on the CT, but in real life, it's just mush. And so you instead, I think a bone block procedure there, it's, you don't want to fall into the same trap of doing a soft tissue procedure for like 10% bone loss, where you just can't fill in enough of that gap with soft tissue. Well, if you've got 25, 30, 40% and you're sticking a coracoid there and you're relying on the conjoint tendon to do its stuff, that conjoint tendon's still too posterior, if you will. And I think it's hard to believe that that's going to do as good of a job as it would under the normal circumstances. And I'll admit, you know, in those folks, I've probably, you know, within the last 2 or 3 years, moved much more to distal tibia. The problem with distal tibia that you know, you can't get around is it's a really expensive graft. And you've got to have, you know, a good sort of justification for why you're using that over something else. For me, I'll admit I like it in the much, much younger people where you've started to run out of options there. Because, you know, it's unfortunate, but every now and then, you know, for me, every 2 or 3 years, you'll get that patient who, even with the distal tibia, it's healed, it looks good, but their soft tissue was such junk, they're still unstable. And you start talking about glenohumeral fusion. And I'll tell you, you go in and do a fusion on someone with a well-healed distal tibia, it looks like regular cartilage. Like, you go in there and it looks like a native glenoid. And I can definitely, fortunately, I don't have the numbers to make any definitive comment here, but in the very few times that's come up for me, you feel like you get good healing and it fuses like it's supposed to. And so it's sort of nice. You know, you start getting into these patients you meet where it's their fourth instability procedure, fifth instability procedure. Don't kid yourself. You may do their sixth procedure, but you need to think about what their seventh one is or their eighth one is, because you're going to be potentially doing that one too. And so I do like distal tibia for that reason. Now, you move away from that sort of group and it's kind of the traumatic, you know, quote unquote glenoid fracture. Iliac crest is a great, great option. You know, the one thing that I wish that paper had talked about that, you know, I know I've talked to you all about before, the hip pain is not to be taken lightly. Like, you know, you'll see patients at 4 months that if you only look above, you know, the mid waist, they're doing great. But if you ask them, they're like, "Oh yeah, I still have a little, you know, catch here and it still hurts a little bit here." And it's definitely prevalent. I'll put it to you like that. I'm sure there's something out there that's quoted what the prevalence is, but it's not trivial. And so, whereas I think this paper was great, like in, you know, in terms of healing and you don't have that, you know, 50% graft resorption, et cetera. I, none of these things are for free, right? Everything comes with it's I was in physics before I did medicine, and we always just referred to it as the conservation of wretchedness. It's like, you know, mass and energy and momentum, it's just a conserved quantity as wretchedness. And so if you have something that heals really well and does everything, then you get hip pain.
Yeah. No, I think I learned that, like, right, you know, when I was a PT, that's all people could talk about.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was like, whether it was like a cervical fusion or, you know, whatever it might be, where when they took graft there, it was all they could talk about. Yeah. You know, and it was always, my surgeon didn't tell me this would bother me.
Yeah. Yes. And I actually spent more time talking about the donor site morbidity than I do the rehab, quite honestly, because
I'm sure they appreciate that. Cause you know, if the expectation is there, it's just a lot.
They do until the first post-op, then they don't appreciate it anymore either.
I know we're running out of the time we have you. So we're doing this thing at the end where we ask you these five questions kind of in rapid fire. So they have nothing to do with the articles or anything like that.
All right, good. It was my understanding there would be no math.
Yeah, there is no math. Oh, we should add math. That'd be great.
All right, good.
Okay. So I'll go first. What band or artist do you listen to in the OR?
OR is 80s pop. That's the more Debbie Gibson, the better.
Awesome.
So for your arthroscopic shaver and arthroscopic wand, are you foot pedal or handheld?
Foot pedal.
Oh.
So I do the opposite. So I do feet on shoulders and hands on knees.
Why?
I don't know. It's just sort of feels more natural. I guess it probably comes from when I started off, I didn't, you know, you're the junior attending, you don't have help in the OR. So you've got to learn how to balance the leg on your hip and cock it out and you Captain Morgan on it. And so the prospect that you're going to get a foot pedal to work is pretty slim. I'm not coordinated to begin with. And so trying to balance all that and step on a foot pedal, I'd probably be the next patient on the table. So.
All right. What's your favorite surgery?
I think Lattergy or total shoulder arthroplasty. Those are, you know, you guys have heard me say those are kind of your home run surgeries. If you do them really well, your patients love you. They never really come back. You know, your totals come back, you know, for their surveys, the yearly, whatever, but they're just so darn happy. In contrast to like biceps, right? Biceps just kind of hate you less as time goes on. So I've just learned to try and find a way not to do the biceps.
Got it.
What type of shoes do you wear in the OR?
So I've been a New Balance guy for most of my life, but I recently, Dr. Theodore, who you both know and we all love, finally convinced me to wear Hokas. And so I've just accepted gracefully that I'm an old man wearing Hokas in the OR, and I'm much, much happier that way.
Okay. All right. If you can only have one snack before a surgery, what would it be?
I'd go Diet Coke, but if it's an edible snack, I would go probably Pirate Booty, because that seems to be always left over in the snack machine on Lunder 3 there.
Oh, nice. And then my favorite question for you, when you retire, what do you hope your legacy with the Pats will be?
That I took good care of our guys. You know, I think part of the best part about being a team doctor is your anonymity, that, you know, you should not be the guy out in front. You should not be, you know, known for doing anything. And I hope that, you know, when I leave, those guys feel like they had a good doctor who really cared about them and really cared about making sure that they were able to achieve the stuff that they wanted to.
Well, undoubtedly, I'm sure that'll be your legacy. I know that we really appreciate all the time we got to spend with you at Harvard, and your mentorship and your honesty and your transparency with us and telling us when, you know, we needed to do better or.
Which was rarely, if ever. Well, thank you guys for having me. What's that?
I said, telling us when we need to take it down a notch.
Exactly. Yeah. Not being so awesome was usually what I said to Ashley in the OR. So clearly she didn't learn that. But no, it's great to see, you know, two of the superstars continuing to be superstars. And, you know, I look forward to when my shoulder finally gives out, having either one of you put it back together again. So I appreciate that you guys doing this and inviting me on this, and thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for coming. Enjoy your time in Florida.
Yeah, enjoy bingo night.
I will. I'm gonna. We're all competitive in the Price family, so we're going back to it pays to be a winner. So we're getting bingo tastic here.
Awesome. All right. Good luck.
All right. I'll see you guys.
Bye. Thanks for listening to episode 4 of the Sports Docs podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this discussion as much as we did. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram @thesportsdocspod.